You are listening to an InsightView.eu podcast. This year, China's Communist Party celebrates its 100th anniversary. China's leadership has been eager to control the narrative of the party history to show unbroken and planned progress. Indeed, Beijing has created a whitewashed version, which means that Chinese people saying something different are punished. The editor of InsightView asks China expert Jürgen Dellmann, professor, PhD, to provide a more balanced picture of the Communist Party's history. Also, we discuss the future of the Communist Party.
The future is certain. It's only the past that is unpredictable. This was a joke in the Soviet Union. What is the Communist Party's true story?
Well, I think there is no true story when you listen to the Communist Party, at least. The story is written by the people in power in China, so it's changed every time a new leader is there. So this is a long tradition in Chinese history. So now at the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party, Xi Jinping, the current leader, is interested in rewriting the history of the party. So the party is not concerned with the truth about its history. Actually, nobody should concern themselves about that, according to the party, but it's concerned about how its history can prop up the current leadership. So this happened under Mao Zedong to some extent, under his successors, but even more so under Xi Jinping. So if you want to get closer to the true history of the Communist Party of China, then you have to turn to historians, and mainly historians outside China, because those inside China, they have great difficulty in getting close to anything that looks like the truth about the history of the Communist Party. It's all decided at the top by the top leadership of the Communist Party, and it's written in the headquarters of the Communist Party.
Why is the centenary birthday so important for the Communist Party?
For any party, I think a centenary is important because you are proving your ability to survive and your sustainability. And the Communist Party has obviously managed to survive a civil war, to lead a revolution, to build a socialist state, ensure China's sovereignty, build a strong economy, and now make China into a world power on a par with the US. So China has, or the Communist Party has in a way made itself invincible, but also China invincible. And this is why the centenary has been so important for them. The question is, how could this happen? Can we understand this at all? And I illustrate this by an example of how adaptive and also resilient the Chinese Communist Party has been. So in 1949, the Communist Party came into power, and it was said that by themselves that only socialism can save China. Then after a period of socialism, where you could say that the economy did not go that well, then in 79, after Deng Xiaoping had taken over power in 78, the idea was that only capitalism can save China. In Deng Xiaoping's word, it was the socialist market economy, but clearly he meant capitalist mechanisms, which had sort of been eradicated from the Chinese economy up till 1976. Then in 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed, or was on the brink of collapse. It collapsed later. The East Bloc collapsed. China was on the brink of collapsing after the big demonstrations in the country. And then the Chinese Communist Party reflected hard on this and said, should we go in a more reformist direction, more political reforms, or should we try to stick to our guns and do what we are good at? And they decided that only China can save socialism. Then in 2009, China had gone global, became engaged in globalization. We had a financial crisis at the global level. China was not affected that much and came out almost unscathed. And many people thought at the time that only China can save capitalism. And then again in 2017, China had really become a global power. We had an American President Trump who came out and said, well, I don't believe in globalization. I don't want to participate in the global order. And then Xi Jinping comes out at annual Davos meeting in January 2017, just after the inauguration of Trump, and claiming that China will be a protagonist, a persistent protagonist of globalization, and will, in a way, it was seen as only China can save globalization. So the Chinese Communist Party has been presiding over these developments that are inherently paradoxical, it seems, with a resilience and adaptiveness that is really striking and shocking to many. And that's why it's so difficult to understand how could this happen. And it has all happened without fundamental political reforms. There have been constant administrative reforms, economic reforms, and reforms in all aspects of society, education, culture, etc. The Chinese Communist Party has been able to preside over these reforms, but it has never reformed itself. This is a paradox, but it's a paradox that we cannot understand if we don't understand what kind of party the Communist Party is and what kind of political order it presides.
What kind of party is China's Communist Party today?
Well, China's Communist Party is the party in power, but its roots are Leninist, and it is a kind of Leninist party. And Lenin, of course, was the founder of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And the organization of the Communist Party is modeled on that of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which again makes it very surprising to look at what the Communist Party in China has been through. But we shouldn't forget that it is also firmly rooted in tradition for social organization. It started as a revolutionary party. Today, it's obviously the party in power. It's become an administrative and technocratic party. It is a very popular party. A lot of people want to become members. The Communist Party is very keen on recruiting youngsters for the party because if they join at an early stage, they can be formed into becoming good Communist Party members who are loyal to the cause of the Communist Party. So every year they take in about 1.5 million new members. And the latest figure I've seen from right now, actually, where public spokespersons of the party says that now they have about 95 million members out of a total population of 1.4 billion. If you look at the composition of the Communist Party, it represents the total population in a reasonable manner, you could say. So there are about 7 million industrial workers who are members, people working in agriculture, animal husbandry and fishing, about 26 million. And these are figures from 2016. I haven't seen a breakdown since. And the government and Communist Party employees, about 8 million professionals and technical staff in enterprises, including managers and also private entrepreneurs, are about 23 million. Students, about 2 million. And then retirees, you have about 17 million. And others are about 7 million. They are not specified. These figures will not add up, as I said, they are from 2016. But I think the distribution is more or less the same today. It's a popular party. It's a party that you never leave, hardly ever leave. Actually, the party decides whether you leave or not. We haven't heard of many people who leave on their own accord. What it did was that it started as a secret organization. And this is why I said it's rooted in long-standing historical Chinese tradition, because many revolutionary organizations in China over the dynasties have been organized as secret organizations because they were not tolerated by power authorities in the capital, that is the emperor and his administration, and therefore they had to be organized secretly. And the Chinese state has never been very big, so they could actually often undertake their activities without being detected until they were quite big, and maybe gathered enough political support to institute a social or political movement. But they have always been detested by the elite and, as I said, by the authorities in power. And they have been trying to clamp down on them. They have been banned. Leaders have been arrested and executed. And this has happened all over the dynasties. And the same thing happened for the Communist Party during the first 30 years of its existence. But they survived. And it was interesting that the Leninist party organization, I'll come back to that later, what it means, actually was organized in a similar way, because in the Soviet Union, it also started as a secret organization. And you could say that the Communist Party is still organized like a secret organization, the same organizational structure. Of course, it is much more open about what it's doing today, but in some instances, it still behaves like a secret organization. Like, it's very difficult to get into the internal dealings of the Communist Party, how decisions are being made, and how the power games are playing out. And Xi Jinping has especially been intent on strengthening the control of the party over its members. So he very distinctly said, actually a few months ago, that he wouldn't allow any criticism of the Communist Party from party members in the public sphere. If they want to criticize the party, it must happen within the party. And this means in secrecy, obviously. So the most important members of the party, I would say today, are the about 8 million officials, and both in the government and in the Communist Party, and they are largely the leaders of the country. So that means they are largely the leaders within the public administration. They make it to the top of the Communist Party and can eventually become leaders at different levels. But you don't see workers and peasants become leaders of the Communist Party. This is surprising in a way, in a country that claims itself to be a country led by the Alliance of Workers and Peasants. This comes, of course, out of the communist classic Bible, so to speak. And you hardly see any women make it to the top. And I've just been teaching a course, a summer course for students from the Nordic countries. And there was a question from one of the participants who asked, when do you think a woman will become the top leader of China? I said, I don't think it'll be in my lifetime. This was a young woman, and I don't think it will be in her lifetime. Let's say the patriarchal and the traditions, the male domination seems to be very prevalent and persisting at the top of the Communist Party. So it's a very hierarchical, top-driven party. But they have a principle inside the party called democratic centralism. And this means that they can debate really anything as long as the leader allows it. When I talk about the leader at any level of the Communist Party. And then they will seek a consensus. This is what is embodied in this principle of democratic centralism. That again is an old Leninist principle. So you have debates, you can debate, but we hear very little about these debates outside the Communist Party. The party recruits its members from the people, obviously. But in order to become a member, you need to have two mentors who will recommend you. So this is like any other organization of the same type. We also know that from different organizations in our part of the world, also in political organizations. You could say the party has become more and more meritocratic because many of the people who are recruited to the party will also become both administrative and political leaders. So the party has focused on increasing the quality of its membership by measuring it by education over the last more than 20 years. And this, of course, means that will be even more difficult for the less educated industrial worker and peasants to become a new member. The party has spoken throughout its entire life about the relationship between being red and expert. Red means that you are ideologically schooled in the current line of the party, and you're loyal to the party. On the other hand, the party also needs experts, people who can do things and who understand things. And of course, the best thing is if you can combine it. So Mao Zedong, who was the first leader of the People's Republic and the leader of the Chinese Revolution, he was focused on being red. So he said that first you have to be red, only then can you be an expert. Xi Jinping, the current leader, has actually debated this recently and asked that scientists are both red and expert. This means that they should, of course, be allowed to undertake their professional the work as you do it, but they should also know what are the priorities of the political leadership, and they should be loyal to a large extent to the Communist Party. So there's a strong focus on ideology and indoctrination, you could say, especially now under Xi Jinping again. But we should not underestimate the nature of the debate internally in the party. And I have at times been able to discuss this with colleagues or friends, and it can be very lively. But surely the bottom line is that once the decision has been made, once the consensus is there, you abide by it, you don't go against it. However, in reality, this is not always the case, of course. Finally, I would say about the Communist Party that it sees itself as having an almost divine mandate, and that it has the right to lead the country on behalf of the Chinese people. And this means that it is actually an extra legal organization in China, because it leads everything, and it has the principle of self-rectification, which means that even despite all the problems that the Communist Party has seen, despite all the criminal elements that have been disclosed and the people who have not agreed with the leadership and who have been expelled from the party, they still believe that the party can rectify itself and address all its internal issues without outsiders mingling. And this is called self-rectification. So only when the party decides that something should be put to court, then it will be put to court. A Chinese citizen cannot bring the party to court. There's no law sanctioning that. And in recent years under Xi Jinping, we have seen that he has a strong focus on corruption, and he's running an anti-corruption campaign, which I think is seen as a good thing in China by ordinary Chinese. It's like the French Revolution. Whenever somebody from the top is going, it seems to be good fun, actually. Whether it really means anything to the ordinary citizen is a different story. But clearly it sends strong signals into the party organization that Xi Jinping means this seriously, and that it also enforces the need for loyalty to his line. So it has also been used, this anti-corruption campaign, as a tool in the campaign against his opponents internally in the party. And there are lots of examples of that. Anti-corruption is the order of the day. Focus on self-rectification, internal control, no access to external criticism. This is the order of the day of the Communist Party under Xi Jinping. And therefore, in many ways, you could call him what in the Soviet Union they called an apparatchik. He's the man of the system. And the first thing he said at his inauguration in 2012 was that the party controls the party. Nobody else controls the party or manages the party. And he repeated it at his centenary speech. So this is his perception. This is a supra legal organization that is managed because the party has a kind of divine mandate to rule China. And this is very much in line with the dynastic traditions, where there was this idea of the mandate of heaven, that the emperor would ensure that there was balance between the heaven and the human world, and that he was the one who had the mandate to ensure this balance so that heaven was not offended. This also means that eventually, maybe, if the Communist Party does not manage this mandate of heaven to the satisfaction of the people, that actually social or political revolution could occur. But of course, the people who are in power, who are administering this mandate of heaven, will do what they can to suppress it. And this has always been the case in Chinese history.
What kind of political order and system does China have under the Communist Party?
Well, following the Chinese constitution, the political order is called a People's Democratic Dictatorship. This is an idea that came out of the Soviet Union and that was adapted by China in 1949. China has also been a proletarian dictatorship, but now it's a People's Democratic Dictatorship. And this means that the Communist Party sits on top. It's a one-party state organization. So the Communist Party is the party in power. it's a Leninist party with Leninist features. This means that it's an authoritarian party. And some of the Leninist features are that the Communist Party has absolute control over the state. There's a parallel party and state power structure, and it matches, the two matches each other almost one-to-one. But however, in practice, the Communist Party is always number one when it comes to decisions. And this means in practice that the party secretary in any organization at any level has more, has the final say in relation also to the top administrative leader. And the Communist Party has a monopoly on recruitment and deployment of leaders within the government, within the state-owned enterprises. They have a, and this relates to the anti-corruption issue I discussed about, they have an internal legal system that's called the disciplinary system. And this is out of the state's judiciary control. And only, as I said, when the Communist Party decides there's something or a special crime, if they perceive a crime should be put to court, to legal process, then it will happen. They have an absolute monopoly on ideology. And this also means, as I said before, the interpretation of history. They have a monopoly on propaganda and an extensive censorship over the media that has suppressed the free debate in China. It doesn't mean that there's no debate, not at all. But the censorship will intervene as soon as they see that there's a challenge to the existing order or to the existing perceptions of the order. And then the Communist Party tried to control society, or at least influence the society through social organizations that are, which we call in non-governmental organizations. They are not that in China. They are called social organizations, and they are demanded to have a party committee. I think the name of the game in this political order is bureaucratic politics. So the Communist Party has not been used to have an external constituency. The leaders are not being elected by the general populace in any way. And therefore, the political agenda has traditionally been set by administrators or bureaucrats who are working in the system. Of course, China has reformed over the last 40 years. There are now many different interests emerging in society and within the business sector who try to influence the Communist Party. And they have been struggling with how to organize that. They're trying to channel it through these Communist Party-controlled social organizations. The system is highly fragmented because you have these parallel structures, and they're more than that. They're competing with each other. Sometimes they're fighting with each other, and often you don't know where the final policy decision is made. So this is also an opportunity to influence the system, and it also provides dynamics. And it provides the willingness to experiment and compete with each other. And the Chinese Communist Party has always been willing to experiment. And they have moved from very disruptive experiments like the Great Leap Forward way back in the late 50s that almost made China collapse to leading China's development through experiments. And just one example, the special economic zone in Shenzhen, which is now a major world city opposite Hong Kong, started as an experiment that should show how China could open up its economy to the outside world and invite investments in, starting around 1980. So I think the system that China is sitting, that the Communist Party is sitting on top of, as it is fragmented, I think the dynamics are created by these by competition inside the system, by the battles inside the system. But the Communist Party has also proven quite competent in ensuring that the system in times of crisis, but also in times where you have cross-cutting political issues, for example, like climate change, but it could also be more mundane issues like water management along the big rivers. Then you try to set up leadership groups that cut across the bureaucracies. And Xi Jinping has been a master in this. He set up a number of leading groups in China focusing on key strategic areas, and he's in charge of all of these groups. And this sends a signal down the system that the local party secretaries should do the same. They should ensure the integration and the necessary bargaining across these bureaucratic barriers. But surely the bureaucrats in China are the ones who are setting the political agenda largely. And therefore, when I talk to students, I always say that a Chinese politician is always an administrator, and an administrator is always a politician. There's no functional differentiation between them when you come to the leadership level anywhere in China.
What has the Communist Party proven over time?
Well, it has proven a number of things. As I said, from 21 to 1949, it became the leader of a nationalist socialist revolution that was successful. China became independent. From 49 to 76, the Communist Party proved that it could actually create the basis for what they called a socialist development of China. And it was created largely under peace and without interference from any outside power. This was new to China after these 100 years of humiliation. And basically, let's say in the scholarly literature, it is argued that without the institutions that were developed during this period, reforms would not have been possible in China. And actually, the economy developed during the time. It was not a complete disaster. China could still feed itself. So there were some successes during this period. But let's say the major overriding success was that China became independent again and could exert its own sovereignty. And from 1978 and until now, we've seen extensive economic and social reforms and the China's fast-track development. This is well known. I don't have to go into any depth with that. From 92 until now, we have seen China emerging as a new superpower, started with a going out policy to look for resources for China's economic development. But it also led Chinese companies to invest overseas. And this was followed up later by the Belt and Road Initiative. Finally, under Xi Jinping, the top leadership in China recognized that China was now actually becoming a superpower. So under the Xi Jinping leadership, from 2012 onwards, I think the major contribution of Xi Jinping actually is that he has defined this new position of China as a global power and not being shy about it at all. So he's challenging the United States and as a hegemonic superpower. And this is where I think his leadership will be defining for the future. Still, I think he's a man of the system. He's not a big reformer. The reforms continue as they have continued before, but he's not the one who's really focused on that. His agenda is strengthen the party, strengthening the party's ability to exert its power and to maintain its power. And then, of course, his great vision is to reunify China. So you would say from 97 till 2020, we have seen a national reunification with Hong Kong and Macau rejoining China, being reunified with China. We know the issues there. So what about Taiwan? This is the big issue now. And it's very clear that Xi Jinping would like to see Taiwan included into the Great Chinese Union under his leadership. Whether it will happen is a different story, but I think it's his intention.
Is today's Communist Party a more socialist party under the leadership of Xi Jinping compared to the era of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao?
I think the comparison to Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, which was the former leadership, maybe not the best comparison, because they actually paved the way for what Xi Jinping is doing today. In many ways, I think if we talk about socialism, maybe this was not a main concern of them. I don't think the Communist Party is more socialist today in any way. It's more Leninist. It's adhering more to these Leninist principles, and Xi Jinping has really strengthened them. Whether that is socialism, I think only the Chinese Communist Party can decide that. And nobody outside China, I think, would talk about this as socialism. Socialism, at least seen from the perspective outside China, is about the political program. And here you could say, yes, Xi Jinping has focused more on the needy in China's society. He has been at the head of finally eliminating poverty, but he's certainly not the man who delivered most on that program, because it started already in the 80s, and Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao certainly also did their bit. Xi Jinping has taken the last step. But you can see that Xi Jinping may be more focused on rolling out new welfare programs than his predecessors were. So in that sense, I see him more as a social democrat like we know it from the Nordic countries and from Europe. What we see is a strengthened party. It's a more Leninist party than under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, but not necessarily under Mao Zedong. But Mao Zedong wanted to revolutionize the party in a different way than Xi Jinping's efforts to strengthen the rule of the party.
In the same context, today, former Chairman Mao seems to take a more prominent and positive role in the Communist Party's narrative. Mao Zedong is no longer criticized for making grave policy mistakes, which created chaos in the 1960s and 1970s. Is this a deliberate strategy to underscore President Xi Jinping's role as the core leader in the Communist Party?
The short answer is yes. And also the Communist Party's history in Xi Jinping's version should be seen as a harmonious history. So it's the story of building a great party. We don't want to show our dirty linen to the outside world. There's no need to do that. We handle that. We are a party that can handle that internally. This should not be discussed outside the party.
Can the Communist Party and China survive after a strong leader such as Xi Jinping? Could his departure release disintegrating forces, as there are many powerful dynasties and power centers in China, or more precisely, what does it take for the Communist Party to survive?
Well, I think the Communist Party has always shown that it's very resilient and adaptive. So it has survived many internal power struggles, and some of them have been pretty serious. 1989 is an example where there were big demonstrations, not only in Beijing, but around China. And actually, the communist regime was at the brink of collapse because its most loyal supporters, people in government organizations all over China, they were actually protesting against the Communist Party. And this is why Deng Xiaoping eventually decided that a military intervention was necessary. But this was not the first time, and it would probably not be the last time that we see similar struggles. And this was the reason why we saw it in 89 was that there was disagreement within the leadership. So somebody wanted to pursue political reform, whereas others didn't want to do that. So you could say that what the Communist Party learned from 1989 and in fact from continuous power struggles is that it has some procedures in place, rules of the game, which are managed by the top leadership. And essentially, when it gets to a real power struggle, it is the top leader that has to show that he can manage this type of situation. So the main thing is not to lose control over the top leadership, and that you see internal debates or even rifts, controversies within the top leadership. And secondly, not to lose control over society and political support from society. The system that has developed is, of course, not a democratic system. China has never been a liberal democracy apart from a very, very short period in 1912. So the Chinese people have no experience with liberal democracy, and they have no education in it. And there doesn't seem to be a great demand. What the Communist Party has to do is to ensure that it has the political support of its people, and it has a strong focus on that. So as long as it does that by delivering public goods and services that are in demand and that are appreciated by, let's say, the majority of the population, I think the Communist Party can survive for a long time. But I also often say that it could collapse tomorrow, just like it almost happened in 1989. The only reason why it should happen, at least at this stage in history, would be internal rift in the top leadership. And this could lead to protests. And so a social movement, maybe a political movement, forming somewhere in China and getting out of control. This is the great fear of the top leadership, and Xi Jinping is very much aware of that. But he's also aware that that there is a social contract. We deliver, you support us.
Last week, President Xi Jinping, in a celebration speech on July 1st, said that the Chinese people have never bullied, oppressed, or enslaved the people of other countries. Is it the truth? Has China always been a peaceful country?
Well, I'm a scientist, and of course, here you need to understand what is the Chinese people. Well, if you only talk about the Chinese people, this may be true, but it's certainly not true about the dynasties. And you've had continuous expansion of the Chinese empire over the years since the first empire. So there has been wars fought, and the Chinese empire has continuously expanded until the size that we know today, and it hasn't finished. And of course, now Taiwan is outstanding, but you could say the last big colonization that happened by the Chinese empire was during the Qing dynasty, which was, by the way, not Chinese. It was a foreign dynasty. So this definition of Chinese people is also, you know, something that you have to look at when you talk about the issues like this one. But anyway, the last colonization was of Xinjiang, which was conquered by the Qing dynasty in the late 18th century. And you could say what we're seeing now is the final assimilation of Xinjiang into the Chinese nation. So in that sense, I think as I said, leave the history to the historians. This statement is for consumption by those who are supposed to support the Communist Party. So you've seen internal suppression, you've seen an internal colonialism, and you've also seen that China attacked Vietnam in 1978. So it's not entirely true even under communism, China is not trying to bully other people. This is a statement that really deserves to be debated. It's a statement that does not stand up to the truth. But of course, it all depends on how you define the question you are examining. And this is what I'm saying as a scientist. I would define it otherwise.
In the same speech on July 1st, Xi Jinping warned that outside forces who try to bully, oppress or enslave China will be crushed to death before the Great Wall of Steel built with the flesh and blood of 1.4 billion Chinese people. This gives rise to the question of whether the Great Wall really has been so successful?
Yeah, that's a good question. Clearly, it's not been successful because some of the Chinese dynasties are actually dynasties that have been the result of foreign conquest by so-called barbarians, as the Han Chinese have called them. So even the last dynasty, the Qing dynasty, was established by a barbarian tribe in the northeastern part of China today, but it also occupied parts of Siberia. And they have been seen as barbarians all through Chinese history. So they managed to conquer China and to make it what it is today, actually, territorially. The interesting thing is that these foreign dynasties somehow realized that if they wanted to rule over China, they had to adapt to Chinese traditions, especially, of course, its political culture, and understand the way that the Chinese empires had been ruled, and by which procedures and practices, way of doing things, and they were very quick to learn that. So they have been in these foreign tribes or barbarians, they have been under the influence of Chinese culture for hundreds of years. So they had a good understanding of that. The last dynasty tried to reform the political organization and were successful in doing that to some extent, but they were also quick to adapt to Chinese political culture in many other aspects and recognize the importance of Chinese traditions. So I think the wall has never been successful in holding out China's enemies. What Xi Jinping is talking about here is a symbolic wall. Now he's talking about the Great Wall of Steel built with the flesh and blood of over 1.4 billion Chinese people. So he's talking about the present Great Wall. And I don't know what he means by steel. I guess he's signaling that it's impenetrable, but otherwise it's a wall that ensures that China can maintain its sovereignty. It can ensure that China will not be humiliated again. So he's talking or speaking into this discourse that has been, as I said, the fuel of the Communist Party and of the Chinese nationalism for the last 200 years. So this is not going away. And I think the Chinese people are really proud about this achievement. We shouldn't misunderstand that. And therefore, it's difficult maybe to understand an expression like this one. But What he's saying is that we will fight for our sovereignty to the end, and you will never be allowed, you foreigners or you foreign governments, to interfere with our internal affairs. That's what he's saying. Let's say the allusion to the Great Wall is not that good an allusion, because it's never really been successful in holding out the enemies.
There's no doubt that the speech on July 1st has made wave in our part of the world. I also have to admit that I feel very much like Bill Bishop, a China expert, after reading the translation of President Xi's speech. It is becoming more evident that than ever before that Mr. Xi wants decoupling. This means that individuals and companies need to show full commitment to China in all aspects of life. Beijing targeting Didi shortly after the Beijing located company was listed in New York is evidence of that, or at least according to Inside View. Do you share this assessment?
I would say not completely. I think there's no way that China could decouple from the world. But I think what he's speaking to is that there's a national agenda and an international agenda, and they have somehow to merge under the leadership and control of the Communist Party of China. A company like Didi and Alibaba and financial, they are big private companies, and they have proven to be successful without the control, the direct control at least, by the Communist Party. And now they are in a situation where they can show their power in a way. And of course their power lies in data, the way they have generated the business around the data they gather, and they use the data. And sometimes they trespass borders because they haven't aligned with the Communist Party's agenda. So I think what is happening is that we are seeing the Communist Party wanting more influence on what these companies do. So Didi wanted to go ahead with this IPO. The Communist Party thinks, it seems, that it should have consulted with them before it did it. And by the way, there were a number of issues that they had to clarify with regard to their core commodity data that they hadn't done beforehand. So I think it's not a decoupling in that sense, but it's a strong signal both to Chinese private companies, but also to foreign companies, that on Chinese territory, the Communist Party is in control, but that the Communist Party also wants more influence on what these companies do internationally. This is seen from the perspective of the Communist Party, I would say. And whether it's feasible is another thing. But I have not seen Xi Jinping declare in any way that China was going for decoupling. But he still has this position that you have to respect the Communist Party. And in a way, you have to pay tribute to the Communist Party. And we are back to a situation where he more and more looks like an emperor of China and is acting by, let's say, the political cultural tool book of the emperors in demanding this respect from all around the world, not only internally from Chinese actors like Didi. And this makes it more and more difficult. So eventually the result could be decoupling. This is true. But it's not in the cards of Xi Jinping as it is. But he's clearly sending a lot of signals that are very confusing in respect to this, and surely I think he's trying to enforce more control and presence in relation to the business world also, not only Chinese businesses, but also foreign businesses, first and foremost on the Chinese territory, but eventually it seems to be that he wants to pursue the same approach outside China.
Thank you, Jürgen Dellmann, for taking part in this podcast.
You're welcome.